This is the Simon Dell Show, where we take a deep dive into some of the week's most notable business and marketing stories and interview high-performing business leaders and marketing professionals to find out their lessons for success.
Netflix pretty much defines its business and its marketing around TV shows, not around its platform. Maybe it's about taking some more niche shows. Email marketing is one of the most poorly done channels.
What's next? Chocolate-flavoured steak.
Welcome to the Simon Dell Show, episode number 2020. We've made it here. It seems like a milestone, but then at the moment, every episode feels like a milestone. This week, I was recording the spin cycle in Japan. I was in Tokyo Airport on my way back home. I'd been there for 4 days for work. Finally got to see a little bit more of Tokyo than I had done in my previous visit. It is a fascinating city for all of you who've been there. I'm sure you enjoyed it. For all of you who have not been there, get a chance to go. It's a once-in-a-lifetime experience. It is culturally vastly different from what you expect in other Western societies like Australia and America and the UK. But it's absolutely mind-blowing how those guys do things like marketing and advertising and some of the things that end up in adverts, which is you certainly wouldn't see in Australia. So, I was stuck in a little one-hour restroom in Tokyo Airport because that was the only place that I could find that was quiet enough to record the episode. If I was stood out in the concourse, then every 5 minutes you'd have heard announcements for planes leaving over the podcast. So as it is, that all you can actually hear is a jumbo jet revving up its engine outside the window, but there wasn't much I could do about that. So that was the spin cycle this week. My full interview this week is with a young guy from Sydney who works for GP YNR. It's actually just YNR now. He's from YNR. His name is Henry Innes. He's the Engagement Strategy Director. As I say, he's only 25, but he has some interesting stories to tell. He has a lot of good advice for small businesses that I think is definitely worth listening to on the marketing front. And he has a fascinating story about an interview that he did at another agency. And I shan't go into any more than that. I'll let him tell that story, but it's a really, really interesting story. Final little bits of housekeeping. Look, if you want to come and talk to me, ask me a question, get in contact, simon@simondell.com. I'm on LinkedIn, Twitter, just about everywhere else. We have our own Instagram page, the Simon Dell Show Instagram page. So please come and like that. Where else? There's my website, www.simondell.com. I'm actually going to put a transcript up in the podcast section of one of our previous episodes. I've never done that before, but I thought I would give that a go. And I paid for an overseas service to transcribe one of my previous episodes. It's interesting if anyone finds that interesting. Sorry, it's interesting if anyone finds that interesting. That's a terrible sentence. It would be good that if anybody finds that interesting, that they let me know. And that might be something that I continue to do. Otherwise, big thank you again to Gilberto. Gilberto's got a new website that he's not quite ready to launch. So don't contact Gilberto on welovesound.audio because that doesn't exist anymore. He's still got welovesound.com.au, but the .audio address was just way too expensive. So whoever's out there in the ether is controlling the .audio web addresses, they're too expensive, people. But get hold of Gilberto, welovesound.com.au, if you're looking to do your own podcast or for any sort of sound recording. Otherwise, that's pretty much it from me from the intro, and we will jump into the spin cycle with me in Tokyo Airport. Welcome once again to the spin cycle. It's a very special spin cycle because I am somewhere in Japan and our co-hosts, the salmon sashimi of co-hosts Edwina Luck and the tuna sashimi of co-hosts Patrick Condren, are still back in Brisbane.
Yes, welcome. We are. Yes. Hello.
Yeah, whatever.
And I pick on tuna because I was taken to a tuna-only restaurant on Wednesday night.
Is that good?
No. Are you guys tuna fans?
I do like tuna, especially sashimi.
Sashimi is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
Salmon sashimi is...
Salmon's probably my favourite with gin and tonics.
Way above tuna sashimi. Way above. Hence the introduction.
I think you could probably put them on a par, but anyway.
Anyway, well, there you go. So theoretically, I've said something nice about
Things
you.
Are looking up for you, Pat.
We're going to talk about, or one of you is going to talk about grapes, because both of you wanted to talk about grapes, didn't you?
I love this story. So who's doing
the grapes for us?
I'm going to talk about grapes. The first thing I'm going to say is, in this country, it's not called cotton candy. It is called fairy floss.
That's right.
The first thing. They're being marketed as cotton candy. That's because these were first grown in America about 8 years ago, and the first crop was planted in Australia in 2014. In America, apparently, it is something of a frenzy happening because you can imagine the fatty boombas in Trump land thinking, this is terrific, these aren't good for me, they taste like cotton candy. And that's my beef, I think, with this particular product. While you have dietitians and nutritionists all trumpeting that this could increase the consumption of fruit, what lesson is it teaching our kids? So you get a grape out of the fridge, or a handful of grapes out of the fridge. They taste like fairy floss. You go to the Ekka, which is the show, which is the fair in Brisbane. You get fairy floss, and you think, the kid thinks, this is good for me. Why can't they just be left to taste like grapes? What's next? Chocolate-flavoured steak, banana-flavoured broccoli. It's bonkers. And admittedly, having said that, let me say this, they're not genetically modified.
They're not.
Well, not genetically modified in terms of in the laboratory.
Yeah.
Because everything that we eat these days, everything we eat is genetically modified in some way, shape or form, whether it be naturally or in the laboratory.
How do they make it taste like candy floss? How does that
well,
even happen?
Well, the breeder in America used a special budwood, which was a graft of rootstock of plants from different parts of the world to, in quotes, to crossbreed the different varieties together to create the flavour. So he's taken a whole lot of different grapes and blended them together.
Right.
And good on him and well done, but I think it sets a difficult precedent. When everyone's talking about obesity, how fat we all are.
Well, we are the fattest.
What do you reckon,
country,
Eddie?
Well, yeah, it's not a fruit made by a mad professor. Surprisingly, he injected his vines, not his veins, with artificial flavours. And they were, as Pat says, created the old-fashioned way through cross-pollination. And his name is horticulturalist David Kane, for anyone who wants to have a little look-see. I think it's really interesting because he says that a lot of fruit has become tasteless by the time somebody buys it. And we know that our apples are sprayed and they're kept, goodness knows, somewhere for months on end. And tomatoes the same. I mean, if tomatoes don't taste like tomatoes that I remember growing up. So this thing for me, it plays on nostalgia because, you know, remember, as you said, Pat, the Ekka. The carnival.
How does it play on nostalgia?
Because
it doesn't play on nostalgia at all. That's bonkers.
They're tasty.
It plays on people's base interest in eating crap.
I let you chat, so it's time for me to have a little
wordy.
Well,
I just think you need to. Obviously, what I said was poignant and pointed, whereas you're drifting a little bit there, I think. Yeah.
No, I don't think so, because a normal grape has 17% sugar. This grape, it only has 3% more, but it's still far.
Oh, so it's got 20% sugar.
Yeah, but it's far less than sultanas, which kids consume.
You're not really defending it here, though.
You're not doing a good job at defending it. My point specifically is that it trains children poorly.
No,
it trains kids.
It's fruit
to
and
think
it tastes sweet.
It trains kids to think that fairy floss is good for you.
It's a slippery slope. It's in the fruit and veg aisle. You're having it for lunch. Your friends are going, oh, what are those grapes? And you go, they taste awesome. And, you know,
So it's got a very short growing season. So what happens when the fairy floss flavoured grapes run out and you've got to start taking ordinary grapes. So the kid that had already fairy floss, next time the kid comes up, give us some more of those grapes. He said, I haven't got those anymore.
No,
I've only got these ones.
Simplistic.
Then he's on the knuckle. No. Then there's bullying.
No. Well, no. Okay. It's basically grooming you to like this fruit.
No.
And then you go, okay, well, maybe that's what a normal grape tastes like. And we know, research says that as you grow older, you don't like the sweet things anymore. You know, you like sweet things when you're
place.
Young.
As soon as this is finished, I've got a tub of vanilla ice cream in there that I've demolished.
But now you've got old, your taste buds like those sweet things again. So, but you're going to hate this pack because they've made moondrops and teardrop varieties. So that's going to blow your taste buds.
Anyway, the question I've got out of all this, has anybody tried making wine out of these grapes? Because I'd be interested to see know what the wine tastes like.
Well, it's interesting you say that because the world has dozens of grape species, but we only ever see one, which is the Vitis vinifera, and that's why this horticulturalist David Kane has decided that he's going to look at other grapes to make them more consumable. Profitable. Mm.
So these are table grapes. Normal, for example, seedless grapes sell from between $3 and $5 a kilo. Fairy floss grapes between $6 and $8 a kilo. So it's pricing, you know, the lower socioeconomic people who can't afford it, they're priced out of the market for starters.
And they're the ones more likely to buy them, aren't they, really?
Yeah. Well, of course they are. So they're going to spend more money on VB, Winnie Reds, and Fairy Floss grapes, and so they've got less money to spend on other areas.
Anyway, we'll move on to the others. I'd like to hear if anyone actually tries these because I still don't believe they're going to taste like candy floss. To me,
well, I've got to tell you, people have tried them in my close vicinity, and they taste like fairy floss.
There you go. The other story we want to talk about this week is a Brisbane brand that was going absolutely gangbusters until recently. All of you out there who are into your donuts, so we're moving from candy floss flavored grapes to donuts. Has probably
it didn't taste like donuts.
No.
Well, has eaten a donut from Donut Time, and Donut Time sadly went bust. This week or last week, the administrators were called in, ran out of cash, lots of staff unpaid, lots of superannuation owed.
And that's the worst part of this story. And it just goes to show, if you make donuts that look better on Instagram than they do in your mouth, then it's a recipe for disaster.
Well, to me, the story is for this, because I think it had a great brand. I think they did an absolute fantastic job from the go with branding, with images, with stores, with the product. He said they got everything right, which to me is what makes this story so much more depressing, is that you can actually get everything right and build up this following and build up this big social media following, but you can still fuck it all up if you don't manage the money properly at the end of the day.
That's right.
Did you like the brand, Eddie?
I thought it was very clever, very simplistic, and they really went for that young schoolgirl target audience who Insta everything. And it really was a magical brand, and it's very sad to read about it. You know, their price point was really high. Their calorie intake, and we're talking what, $6 for a donut, but people paid and they paid and they bought, you know, four in a pack instead of just one.
They were awful.
They were fantastic.
The donuts were awful.
When did you eat them? Because that brings me to another point. When did you last eat a Donut Time donut?
I don't know. Whenever the kids had one left over.
The interesting thing I found was that there was lots of stories from the staff about how they changed the dough mixture or the process of making the dough mixture or something like that. They were bringing it in. I don't know, you know, making it centrally and then sending it out to all the stores or something like that. Mm. But somewhere through that, they'd And to me, that was the absolute cardinal sin of a brand, is changing the recipe. Mm. And we spoke about that last week, I think we did, you know, with the crisps, but we spoke about, and Pat's mentioned it this evening, VB. I think VB changed their recipe. There's a history of brands changing their recipe. And at no point has it ever gone well for a brand. And that's one of the things I look back on this and think, you know, guys, there's one of your first mistakes.
It's actually sad, isn't it?
So why did they change the dough?
Well, they probably were cost-cutting. They probably got greedy and they probably went, you know what, we're so popular now, let's try and just milk this. And instead of going, well, we're providing this amazing benefit, this amazing product, solution for hunger, solution for hanging out with friends, and we're earning enough money, why do we have to change the recipe? Why do we?
And the second lesson that I took from this whole debacle was that when they went bust a couple of weeks ago, there was a lot of commentary and a lot of information coming out of some of the senior management saying some of the rents that they were paying for premium spots in shopping centres, etc., etc., was absolutely exorbitant.
Which it would have been,
absolutely. You know, Westfield aren't cheap, and despite the fact that shopping centres are in this turmoil of identity, they're still charging through the nose for square metres. The question that keeps coming to me is going, these weren't stupid people. The CEO, who is now bust and bankrupt, and people are chasing him and everything, was a former lawyer. Why do people with these successful brands sign these ridiculously expensive leases? I just don't get that somebody doesn't do a cost analysis of the amount of donuts that you need to sell in order to actually make a buck or two in a shopping centre.
Are you saying that they didn't need to be in these high-profile places?
I think what I'm saying is not they didn't need to be, but there are so many shopping centres that would be desperate for good quality food retailers that they could have negotiated a bit better.
Well, they had such a strong brand, so they
exactly.
Could,
when you've got a strong brand like that, you don't
need to be. Well, I suppose that's where the people are. So that's where you want your brand to be to get good brand exposure. But if this guy was a lawyer,
but see, there was a place down
an accountant.
There was a place down just on the northern fringes of the valley. It was like a hole in the wall,
and
people would drive there. Parking was impossible, and people would drive there to buy these donuts. So I suppose, did they need to be in those high-profile areas to sell their donuts if people are prepared to, you know, drive and be inconvenienced in an effort to buy these
$6
disgusting donuts?
If people were prepared to be inconvenienced for that, and they didn't go into the high-profile places, and they just went into those hole in the walls like you suggested, Pat, and let's say they made less money, but they probably would have been in a much more financially sound position, even though they were making less money, because their overheads would have been a lot less.
Yeah, so they've gotten too greedy.
Yeah, and they could have treated their staff a bit better as well.
Yeah, like, I think that's, you know, sorry, go on, Ed.
No, I'm just saying they could have treated their staff really well and not having to work at a shopping centre, and just had the hole in the wall and maybe got an extra person in there, just providing that extra value, because people look for value. They're paying a lot of money. So you need to keep value adding, and not by new flavours, but by little incremental things, like, and I'm not talking a loyalty card, but just being nice to your customers and not being greedy.
I think out of all of this, the big lesson for me is that anybody out there who's running a business or working in a business, you can create a fantastic brand, great product, great branding, great logo, all of those great messaging, all of those things, but it only takes like one brick to be pulled out of the bottom of the pile for the whole thing to collapse around you. It's so important that people are constantly looking at every aspect of their business.
And it's interesting, particularly these days, given in my local area, there's a central, what you'd call, Simon, a high street area.
Yeah.
And there's three or four vacant shops.
Yeah.
That are boarded up, and it makes the whole place feel gloomy and dingy. But I think that's also a sign of how tough it is when you're running a small business these days.
Yeah.
But then you look at success stories like Merlot, for example, who have, you know, they're branching out and they've obviously got a good business plan.
And the one I always talk about is Guzman and Gomez, who are just opening stores like it's going out of fashion. They must be doing, obviously they're doing a roaring trade, but they must be doing a serious cost-benefit analysis on all of the stores that they're taking on before committing to leases. Or they're just being sharp enough to only be signing short leases or leases where they've got a get-out clause or, something like that.
Did you say shirt off enough?
Did I say shirt off enough? No, I didn't.
I know you're in a room in a hotel room by yourself. Please tell me you're not doing this in the nude.
No, I just for everyone's benefit, I'm in a day. I've never been in a day room before in a hotel. I couldn't find anywhere quiet because people kept talking over the intercom in Japanese, and it would have just. And I couldn't ask. I couldn't ask Gilberto to try and edit that out because that would have taken up a whole weekend of his, and I think that's unfair.
Can I just drag us back to what we were talking about briefly? Yes. Enough of you and your travails in Japan. Is that it for donut time? Because I know the CEO was trying to trying to take it over and save the remaining stores.
The chairman or one of the managing directors or something was trying to take it over, but I don't think it's...
That's so right. The CEO was trying to buy it from the owner, owner wouldn't sign over the trademark. So this is where this law, the legal aspects come in, and they're so important because, trademarks are so important, and it's really sad because as we going back to when you started this story, Simon, the brand is so good, it's so perfect, and if only he would have signed it over, because I was talking to my 20-year-old daughter yesterday about this exact thing, and she went, "This is just so sad." I never really went there a lot, but at the same time, it was just you knew it was always there.
I wonder.
Well, it wasn't always there. It hasn't been there, in time immemorial. And for good riddance, as far as I'm concerned, they were shithouse donuts and overpriced.
I wonder if there's an opportunity for someone to actually buy the shell of the brand and relaunch it and re-enter the market as New Donut Time or something like that.
Well, you're going to have to interview a lawyer on that one, because with the IPOs and all the laws around trademarks and logos.
Spell the name differently. Instead of D-O-U-G-H, spell it D-O-N-U-T.
Wow. I think that's how he spelled it.
Anyway, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much for your time this week. I'm getting out on a plane in about an hour's time. Mm. And I have to say, because whilst we're talking about it, as we're talking about brands, I'm flying back by Qantas and it's already 15 minutes late.
Oh.
And I've done this journey. This will be the fourth flight I've been on from Japan. So I've been here twice now. And so far, three of the four have been delayed.
Yeah.
Well, there's a storm here in Australia. There's a cyclone, so they're worried.
Yeah, don't wake up. No, don't be ridiculous. That's bonkers. The last time I flew back from the States with two teenagers, we got to check in, 2 hours early, and they looked at us and said, "Oh, it's 3 hours late already."
Anyway,
it drives you. Anyway,
good luck. I'll be back next week.
What's that?
I'll be back next week.
Can't wait.
There's no one else in this room with me. That's it's me, a single bed, and a shower.
Hello, Simon. Hurry up.
What's that?
We'll see you both next week. Thanks very much.
See you, boys. Bye.
I am with today Henry Innes. He is I've just remembered what you were, Henry, and then I've completely forgotten what you were.
National Engagement Planning Director for Young and Rubicon. Australia.
Right, National Engagement Planning.
It's a very long title, isn't it?
Yeah, explain what that means. For the people out there.
So it's quite a funny story. I changed over from a company called VML, which is one of YNR's digital agencies in the region. They were kind of breaking off. And engagement planning is kind of this fancy new buzzword term. It basically means planning out how customers deal with creative and all that kind of thing. In reality, my role is strategy for big brands.
Right,
and I do that nationally across Brisbane, NZ, Australia, and obviously Melbourne and Sydney.
Okay, cool. We'll get to some more, because I think obviously you've got a lot of experience. I think a lot of people will be interested to hear about. I want to take you all the way back. First question I always ask everybody is, what was the first job you did that you actually got paid for? And I mean the very first one.
Oh gosh, I got my first paid job when I was about kind of 14, working as a barista in a local cafe.
Right, okay.
And I was mostly just stealing milkshakes from the back, to be honest.
Do you make a good coffee though?
To be honest, I've lost the touch a bit. It's I was making a coffee in the office the other day, and I realised that I kind of overfrothed the milk and things like that. And someone said, you make a shit coffee now, and I kind of thought to myself, oh no, I'm getting old.
Okay. How long did you do that for?
I did that for probably 3 years, and then I went into nightclub promoting when I was 17 with a fake ID.
Well, I'll get to that in a minute. What did you pick? What are some of the things that you learned? I mean, I think, everyone I talk to is really impressionable in their teenage years when they do their first jobs. But what are some of the things that you remember about, lessons that you learned or things that you learned within that time serving coffee?
Oh, I think it's really interesting because I think watching people, I'm a people watcher, watching people kind of in a small cafe when you're watching people talk. You kind of notice that everyone is talking, not listening a lot. I think that's the first thing you notice. The other thing that really stuck out to me was just how much people actually crave conversation. We used to have people come down to that coffee, and it used to be probably some of the only human contact they got that day. Right, it was just part of their routine.
What sort of people were you dealing with? Was it sort of in office block type thing?
No, I was actually on a small island called Dangar Island, which is where I grew up, the Hawkesbury River.
Yeah, that's interesting that people will come and engage just for conversation more than for coffee.
Yeah, well, I think that's the thing. Coffee's kind of like one of those rituals, right, where people kind of come down, they have their morning coffee and things like that. They have the people that they see. I mean, I know I do that today. So I think it's really interesting as well that you get people into these patterns and these routines, and they are quite resistant to changing from them. Like, I know I will always go for my coffee at 9, 10 a.m. on the dot. And I think that the same would be true of a lot of people.
My father goes and buys a newspaper every day back in the UK, and he ends up in a 45-minute conversation with the bloke who sells him the newspaper. And it stuns me every day. I go, what have you got to talk about with this guy every day? It's 45 minutes. What are you doing down there? What are you talking about today that you didn't talk about yesterday and the day before that?
Whereabouts in the UK is that?
They live in Tunbridge Wells in Kent, just outside.
Oh, okay. Just outside London. Well, yeah, they love to talk there, so...
Yeah, my father's always been one who's always been a talker, which is perhaps why I've ended up doing this podcast. Just that's my channel of talking to people. I hate it when people call me. I'm not good on the phone. Face to face podcast, great. I just don't really want to talk to people on the phone, which is weird.
Yeah.
So and nightclub promoting at 17 with a fake ID.
Yeah.
Tell me why, how, where.
Well, I won't say who it was for because they were getting a lot of
trouble. Yeah.
They're getting a lot of trouble. But it was kind of for a couple of people. It was in a nightclub district in Sydney. We kind of used to go out and you try and drum up names to go to these nightclubs. And of course, I was kind of going clubbing with a group of friends a lot. And so I kind of just did it. My parents were horrified. But it was great fun. It was great fun. And you met the whole, I met people there that, I still meet today. So, there's some people I've met who were in that scene who I kind of now know as bankers or something like that, because everyone clubs when they're 18. So,
yeah. Well, yeah, was it standing on the front door and saying hi to all the hot girls as well, or, you know?
No, because you see, I was quite a fat bloke, so you didn't really want me on the front door.
You were more of a behind-the-scenes guy.
Yeah, I was more right. just get the listing, kind of get the unattractive people who'd buy drinks in.
Spenders, but not the good-looking ones.
The high spenders, not good-lookers. Yeah, that's my target demographic. I still think that's my target demographic.
Let's hope none of your clients are listening to this.
I think it was a very enlightening job. It just tells you a lot about human behavior, doesn't it, really?
Yeah.
But I wasn't very good at it, though, for kind of too long, so.
The other thing I picked up from your LinkedIn profile was what you went and did as a degree, because that I'm interested in why and how you chose, was it history and anthropology?
Yeah, it was history and anthropology. I mean, to be perfectly frank, I didn't actually end up finishing it, which notice on that, because I entered full-time work. It was mostly because I just didn't really know what I wanted to do and just kind of thought, actually, that seems broad enough that I'm not really going to fuck anything up. And it's not going to be intense like law, and I can kind of experience uni life a bit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you think you were perhaps, you're just looking to maybe cruise through something in uni?
I think that's probably a very accurate way of putting it. Yeah.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, Andy, but I'm kind of getting the sense that that was... I wish I'd had the foresight you did, because I ended up I did a double degree in law and politics, and all I wanted to do was cruise through, and you do not cruise through with law, so, you know.
Well, that was, I mean, there was that, and I also didn't have the marks to get into law, so that probably had something to do with it.
Lucky. I don't think you've missed anything.
Yeah, well, I was one of those students who was very smart, very lazy, I think, so.
Yeah. Yeah, and which I think a lot of good leaders and a lot of good business people are smart and lazy. There's, you know, it's funny. I've done another podcast today, which, you know, both recorded on the same day but go out on different times. But the guy that I spoke to early on talked about how he almost killed himself launching his first business, but when he did his second one, it was like, you know, he made sure that he didn't do that again. But you know, I think some people who are smart enough to sit there and go, all right, what's actually going to give me a decent return on investment here?
Well, people always talk about ROI. I talk about ROT, return on my time.
Right. Which
is a much better way to look at it. I kind of go, if I was to do kind of the two to three things well, what's going to make that 80% to 90% difference?
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a really good way of looking at it. So. But so you ended up dropping out of university, and again, don't worry, you're not the only person that I've interviewed on this podcast that's dropped out of university. But what made you decide to just go, you know what, bugger that, let's go and get a job? Was it just the opportunity, or you made a decision before?
It was actually, and I'm still doing a comms degree online, I should say.
Catching up right at, yeah, okay.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So I'm kind of just doing one subject a semester.
Yeah,
But one of the key things that kind of happened was I wanted to do some part-time work in marketing. I kind of got an internship and then got a paid job, which was still part-time, at a content agency called Edge.
Yep.
And then I used to write this digital marketing blog, and being a bit of an asshole 20-year-old, I kind of sent it around to the top 20 CEOs in marketing.
Wow.
In Australia. For the purpose of, and it was just like, oh, I would love your point of view and, you know, to catch up if you were interested in it. And I got an email back from this lovely gentleman called Andrew Baxter, or Billy Baxter, as a lot of people know him as, who offered to have coffee with me. He was the CEO of Ogilvy Australia at the time.
Wow.
And he took me out for an hour and a half. We kind of had a chat and things like that. It would have been about an hour or something like that. He brought me coffee. We were talking about what I wanted to do, where I wanted to go. And he ended up introducing me to a guy called Adam Boper, who was the strategy director at DT, which is now called AKQA.
Right.
And they offered me a job. A big part of that job was that there was a 5-day commitment and things like that, which made doing the degree at Sydney University a bit harder. So it made me just want to transfer a bit more and kind of minimise it. And so that's what ended up happening, basically.
That's kind of a ballsy move, just emailing those, you know, 20 CEOs. What were you thinking that they would respond when you did that, or were you just kind of like accepting that the likelihood of response was going to be pretty low?
I thought the likelihood of response was pretty low, but I also thought, fuck it, what have I got to lose? It's a funny thing. When people are young, I think that before you're 30, you get a lot more leeway with doing a lot of things. You get a lot more leeway with kind of pushing people and emailing people randomly and cold calling people. And I'm just of the belief that people don't do very good cold calls and cold emails and things like that anymore. And because we're all kind of obsessed about what other people will think about us. To be honest, think about the last time you got a cold email from someone. You don't sit there and go, you know what, I'm never going to fucking talk to that person again. And I had a bit of a calculation that was going to be the same. Either they would ignore me or they'd reach out to me. It wouldn't do any harm to my future reputation, so why not?
Yeah. Yeah, I often say to, you know, we talk about a lot of businesses about cold calling, cold email, and again, on the last podcast, we talked about just knocking on doors or picking up the phone. It's at the end of the day, whilst it might irritate some people and annoy some people, you have, certainly in the early stages of careers and the early stages of startups and businesses, you got nothing really big to lose at that point, have you?
No, and I think people overestimate how much, like, it's funny, there's this difference in perception between two sets of people, right? Because you're spending all of this time crafting this email, it means so much to you, there's such a high investment on your side, often with a cold call, that you subconsciously attribute that on the other side. And I think what tends to happen is people go, well, fuck, I spent so much time crafting this, it's spent so much time, and so they think they're putting that same imposition on someone else. If someone wants to ignore you, they'll just delete your email. So it's not really a big deal.
So your first job at AKQA.
Well, it was called DT then, so I've
got to... I call it DT then because it's a bit easier to say.
So it was my first job at DT. I was brought in to do this... I met this guy, Adam Boper, who stuck me on a roof as part of my first test in 40-degree heat to get me to do a 20-minute riding exercise, and that's how I got the job.
Sorry, you're going to have to explain that in a bit more detail. He put you on a roof.
He put me on a roof. So he takes me onto this roof. So this big kind of roof terrace at the Ogilvy building.
Yep.
It was in St. Leonard's at the time. They've moved now. It's 40-degree heat. And he kind of brings out a pencil. I mean, who the fuck brings out a pencil to a writing task? But that's another question. And then he sits me down in this 40-degree heat, and he sticks a statement of work for a client. It was Medibank, I believe. And he goes, talk me through. And he had a clear idea of how he would do it. But he said, talk me through how you would do this, how you would make this into a program. And so I kind of had to start writing notes on the process and how I'd break it out and what the key things I would do would be. And he said, I'll be back in 20 minutes. 15 minutes later, he returns and goes, how are you going? And I just kind of talked him through what I would do and how I would approach it. And it was just about trying to just go through things quite logically and sequentially rather than trying to do everything at once.
Yeah.
And he gave me the job. And in my first week, I was tasked with putting together this report for Medibank.
And he had you doing that on the roof in the sunshine?
He had me doing that on the roof in the sunshine, yeah.
Do you think, looking back on it, do you think that was deliberate, or he just didn't even contemplate that you were in the sunshine?
Oh, it was 100% deliberate. He's boasted, he's boasted about it to people.
Oh, okay. Wow. And so... Right, so explain to me, when he boasts about it, what's his reasoning about it? Is it just a test? Are you supposed to ask if you can go and sit inside, or are you just supposed to deal with the heat?
No, I think it's a test under pressure, right? It's to put you in kind of unfamiliar, not office-like environment, and just see how you react. it's not like I was dehydrated out there. He did bring me a glass of water. But, you know, it's just to see how you react in different circumstances.
Okay. Does he still do it?
I'm not sure, but knowing him, probably.
I was going to say, so if anybody's going for a job with him, like in the next, you know, next 6 months, take sunscreen and a hat with you.
Yes, that would be very good advice.
That's Henry's advice for getting a job at DT. So what other stuff did you work on there? What was perhaps one of the highlights that you worked on there in terms of a client?
Well, I'm most proud of the work I did on the Optus account there. So I worked with Optus for quite a while. I got thrown on the deep end there. We kind of crafted a really, really cool campaign on Facebook, which was all about using Facebook's data quite laterally. So we'd look at things like time of Facebook app install and that kind of thing. And what that would do is that would allow us to understand kind of different life cycles. So, for example, we started marketing to people based on contract length that they were in. And, you know, and that was a bit of a change for them, because if you think about a marketing budget on a telco, if you're kind of going out mass market, your marketing budget has a high amount of wastage, because what you often doing is you're marketing to people who are in month six of their contract, right?
Yeah.
And they're sitting there going, well, fuck, I'm seeing these great ads and deals from an Optus or something like that, but I actually can't break my contract or anything like that.
Yeah.
So what it was about is building a life cycle around it. And what you found is that kind of month zero to 12, someone was often in the mindset of they're often frustrated with their new telco. That's very, very common. And that because you experience a complaint or a big bill or something like that. And then what happens from there is people go, well, okay, I'm frustrated and annoyed, so I'm going to move. I want to move telco. So it's the best time to be talking about your telco's benefits, your new how you're upgrading your network, all the things that aren't really going to drive someone to convert, but brand building in their head. And then you start to talk about new phones in the later months. So if you're going from month 20 to 24, you're not actually thinking about the telco you want to be with. You're thinking about the phone first, and the new phone, because your phone's probably 2 years old. It's a bit slow. It's a bit annoying. So you need to almost market phone first and then position the network as supporting the phone. And that's what we did, and it was very, very successful. We kind of worked with some of the leadership team to look at what the future of telcos looked like, particularly kind of because, you know, you have obviously a massively changed role for telcos with the internet, with data becoming kind of the dominant paradigm for a telco. You know, prepaid is increasingly becoming a very difficult territory for them to play in as well. So there's kind of a couple of things that we did there that were very, very interesting. We launched their Netflix partnership. We handled kind of all the digital and acquisition and banner work for that, which was very fun and very, very interesting. And kind of did a lot of that kind of quarter by quarter campaign strategy. But it's the performance marketing stuff around life cycles that I thought was probably my best work.
Couple of questions out of that.
Yeah.
The first one is, what's your feeling with, as Optus with a brand? And obviously, you can be as candid as you like, but, I'm interested to see where you think Optus is as a brand. The second thing I was going to ask you is, obviously the big thing from my perspective that Optus did, 2 years ago, was the Premiership, accessing the Premiership football. Do you think that was a good move or do you think that paid off for them, or how do you think that sits in the great scheme of things for Optus and for the consumers as well?
It's a really great question. So I think what Optus did kind of 3 years ago, just after I left, but we were kind of talking to them about this in some ways, and, you know, and I can be pretty candid here because I don't work with them anymore. I haven't for 3 years, but as a very interested observer, as a brand, they're kind of trying to move away from being a telco. And the reason for that is because telcos are a commoditized business. So if you're in the telco business and you're, there's not much difference between a gigabyte from Vodafone and a gigabyte from Optus. The only thing that might be different is network coverage, but increasingly that gap is being closed as well. So what Optus has done, and it's pretty well documented, is said they're going to be an entertainment company, which I think's interesting for a couple of reasons. One, it changes their competitive set, because if you're an entertainment company, you're competing with Netflix as much as with kind of Vodafone. Two, it locks people into their content properties. As a brand, how well they've executed on that strategy, I'm not so sure. Because if I was Optus, what I would be doing is doubling down on content rights. Which is, they started to do that with the EPL, and the EPL, I think, netted them around 150,000 customers, which is not too bad. But if you think about kind of EPL, NRL, AFL, kind of 5 or 6 dig, and, you know, maybe it's Game of Thrones or something like that, they need to double down on kind of buying those shows, and they are only available for Optus users, and then marketing the shit out of that. Because if I see a poster that says Game of Thrones only available on Optus customers, of course that's going to shift the dial in number of customers. You know, and we've seen that with Netflix. We've seen that with Stan. Stan has massive incremental gains with the number of people that have joined their service ever since they started really marketing their content and really focusing on their content. You've seen the same thing with Netflix. I mean, Netflix pretty much defines its business and its marketing around TV shows, not around its platform. So if you want to be in the entertainment business, I think you've got to do that. I'm not sure. I think they've started that. Do I think they've done it well? I'm not so sure. And I think that's his challenge with a great sounding strategy is it's really easy to put on paper. But, I mean, fuck, unless you're going to put the money where the mouth is, which is expensive and it's an investment, it is hard to do.
Couple of things out of that as well. I think I tend to agree with you. I think Netflix, you're either all in or you're all out when it comes to entertainment.
Exactly.
There is no kind of middle ground. And I think you're absolutely right. There's that they started with a bang, and then everyone's sort of going, right, well, what's next? You know, and I don't think they've followed it up at all. The question that I would also then take out of that is, and we're digressing slightly, but I'm really interested in your opinion on this, is when you talk about content and when you mention things like Game of Thrones and Netflix and HBO and all those kind of channels and properties and things like that, I think the big challenge at the moment is there's very few TV shows and very few content properties that people give a shit enough about to switch provider. And I'm going to use the EPL because I think that's one. And you said that obviously that gained them 150,000 net users or whatever. Game of Thrones would be another. But when you drop down from that top tier, I think there's a lot of people. I mean, I look at Stan, for example, and I go, there's a lot of good content that I would watch on Stan, but can I be asked having another streaming service in my life? Probably not. Do you think that's the case, or do you think people will switch and go after that there's enough top tier content to make people switch?
Yeah, but here's the thing. I think for a business, like if you're talking about Netflix and things like that, I take your point. But if you're talking about Optus as a business where its financial competitive set is Telstra and Vodafone, I think that's less of an issue because all they need is one massive tentpole property, right?
Yeah.
And then you go, well, come fucking Game of Thrones time, there's all these Optus posters up around Game of Thrones releasing for Optus customers only, and and Telstra customers are seeing all the trailers and things like that. You actually think you miss out on something quite cultural. Do I think these shows exist out there? Yes. I mean, you know, there's Orange is the New Black, there's House of Cards, there's Arrested Development. There's enough that would make a significant difference to the perception of a telco.
Would you switch from one telco to another for Orange is the New Black?
Well, if they're all pretty much commoditized, then yes. I just tend to think there'd be a large number of people who would. I mean,
okay. I'm on the fence on it, but
Orange is the New Black is probably a bad example for us to talk about because we're men. But for women, I think, you know, orange is black, hugely popular.
Yeah, I think about my wife likes that and Wentworth anywhere where women are being locked up for some strange reason. But yeah, so she would, like if someone said, you know, you could only get Wentworth on an Optus plan, she'd be over on Optus straight away.
Exactly. And, you know, and maybe it's about taking some more niche shows, but I think the fact that you can kind of have these entertainment propositions locked into a telco is very interesting. It just needs to be executed. I think one of the good things they have done is made Netflix and Stan Unlimited. I know that's hugely useful to consumers, and it's something they don't talk about enough.
Yeah, yeah. All right, but from there, you've got a couple of businesses here, BBE. So who are BBE?
So BBE, I don't even know what the acronym stands for, so you'll have to call them and ask them. I think they just made it up in a pub one day. But it was started by the same guy, Adam Boper,
right.
Who I worked for at DT, and Tim Evans, who I also worked for at DT. I was kind of leaving DT and in the process of leaving it just because I just felt like I needed a bit of a refresh, and I wanted to do something a bit different. And they just said, basically, would you like to come and join us? Once I'd kind of initiated that leaving process. So I think that was quite an exciting time. I was on the path to partnership in that business, which was extremely interesting. And I was kind of probably the first strategist that they employed in the business. So it was a very interesting time. We were working with Medibank a lot. Doing social and content strategy. I mean, probably the key highlight for me there was that some of the platform work that I did. So we did this program called subscriber acquisition, which decreased some of their costs to acquire email addresses by about 50%, which was fascinating. And then we also worked with an ex-Optus client of mine, Karen Phipson, who's a fantastic marketer. She's absolutely brilliant. Developing kind of some of her digital strategy and customer frameworks. And she and I have a very good relationship, so she brought me across. And, it was very, very, very interesting time. The other thing that we did was launched an app called Bond at Schoolies, which was a little bit crazy and interesting.
Were you up in the Gold Coast? Where were you from Schoolies?
I lived in the Gold Coast for a month and a half.
Wow.
At Schoolies. Brave. And it was...
But it was feral there some nights, wasn't it?
It was. You go in there thinking, oh, this can be fun. It was feral. Absolutely feral. I've never seen such a mass of screaming teenagers in my life.
Ah, you're a braver man than me. How old were you at the time?
I was 23. 23.
Okay, so no, you're still, no, you're
22.
Yeah, yeah, so you're still, you're not far off them.
Yeah, well, not too far, but there were some of the people I was working with were much older as well, so
yeah.
It was very interesting.
Yeah, I couldn't think of anything worse than spending 6 weeks on the Gold Coast and when Schoolies is on. Sounds like a...
Yeah, it was tough. It was tough.
So I kind of want to get... I'll talk about the work that you're doing at the moment with Y&R, but I want to get an understanding of all the brands that you've worked with, of all of the businesses that you've worked with, what are some of the things that you see that businesses do really badly? And I want to sort of preface that with thinking more about an average business owner who might have 20 or 30 staff versus a Medibank or an Optus or those kind of things. What do you see that people could
do? Email marketing.
Really?
Email marketing. Yeah, I think that is email marketing, whether you're in a 5-person business or a 50-person business or a 5,000-person business, I think it's one of the most poorly done channels.
In what way? What's done poorly?
So I think that people don't think about the customer at all when it comes to email. What people generally do when they send out emails is they behave like an offers company, right? They're just trying to put another offer in someone's address, in someone's inbox, sorry. And what they're trying to do is just constantly be talking to them and constantly be finding reasons to talk to them about their products. When email is done really, really well, you're giving yourself a reason to talk to someone every week so they remember your brand and build preference for your brand. And it's one of the cheapest and most effective channels to do that. And I'll give you an example. It's the difference between Medibank talking about insurance in their emails every week to talking about food recipes.
Right.
Yeah. And if Medibank are talking about food recipes, it then gives them license to go and talk about stuff like, whatever you want to do, health insurance or health products.
Yeah.
And the same could apply for, say, a 50-person industrial business in kind of rural Queensland, right? If they're talking all hardware stores or something like that.
Yeah.
If you're a 50-person hardware store and you're constantly sending someone, here are the new deals and things like that, unless you are really, really price-driven and like at Bunnings level price-driven, it's very, very hard for someone to go, you know what, I'm going to open that email every week. And so they'll switch off, you'll get moved to the spam folder, and then you've lost your channel to that person.
Yeah.
Whereas if that same business was just going, here's what all of our staff are building this week, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Different proposition.
Absolutely.
And that level of customer centricity is just very apparent in email. And, I mean, it's shit like when you send out an email, don't have the reply email as a do not reply email address. Like, that's just telling your customer you don't give a shit about them.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like why do it? Why advertise that you don't care about your customer?
Yeah. There's two things spring to mind from that example. With the first one, I've had a conversation within the last 12 months with a butcher, and small family run butcher, not a big chain or anything like that. And what I said exactly the same. I said, collect information, collect email addresses of all the people that are coming in. I said, because this is your lifeblood, the people coming through the door and buying, you know, sausages or steaks off you every week. And then I said, and set up some email communication. I said, but it's exactly the same as I said, this is exactly the same thing as you said, is that let's not just use it to tell them what's cheap. Let's use it to teach them how to cook things that you sell, in particular recipes that you've created, because they'll keep those emails. If it's a good recipe and they enjoy it, they'll come in and buy the product, and then they will keep that email so that their family can have it again.
Hmm.
And that is a very small difference. It's a small difference between the content that goes in an email that say, you know, steaks are this price, sausages are this price, versus, you know, here's how to make a whatever particular steak. It's not a massive difference, but it's a bit of a difference in mindset.
Exactly.
And the second thing that the one that I always remember and just shits me to tears, and I crossed them off my, I put them into spam probably 3 months ago, was Fish Pond. And Fish Pond are the booksellers, on the online booksellers. They're the kind of, they were the Australian Amazon type thing. And it must be a really small run company, because I wanted to support them. I wanted to keep buying books through them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But they keep sending me emails of books that are wholly unrelated to anything I've browsed for on their website and completely unrelated to anything that I've bought or is slightly bit interested in buying. Whereas you get Amazon's emails, absolutely on point with exactly what you're interested in. And I think whilst all their small businesses out there can't be Amazon, they can all do a much better job of the content that they're sharing out with people.
Couldn't agree more.
What about some of the other things that you think businesses could be doing better out there?
I mean, social media is such an oversaid one, right? But I think if you're a small business looking to do local area marketing, you cannot go past Facebook and its data set. Really targeted, strong local marketing can be done very, very well on Facebook. And I just think it's a really underutilized channel. I think Facebook's location targeting in particular is badly used for retail footprints and retail stores in particular.
Yeah.
The other kind of key thing I'd say is, well, there's two more key points. One, creativity. I think small businesses don't go, how do we be a little bit more creative and interesting? They're too risk averse at times. When you're a small business, it's different from being an Optus, right? You can actually do some fun and weird shit when you're a small business. And the second thing as well is embracing new technology. So, I mean, I'm working with a business at the moment called Flowbox, which is a fantastic piece of AI-driven software, started in the small business segment, just didn't have enough uptake. And what we're finding is that enterprise businesses, and it's AI Facebook marketing, and enterprise businesses are kind of more willing to take the risks than small businesses on these sorts of things, which is really surprising to me.
I like your point about small businesses can be more creative. And I think that's completely the opposite way they think, because they sit there and go, well, as a small business, I can't be creative because I don't have the budgets of an Optus or a Medibank in order to employ people to be creative. And I think small businesses need to be able to go, the benefit we've got is that we've got people around us. We've got people working in the business or family or friends. Let's ask them for some creative ideas. Let's, you know, get them all pissed at a barbecue and see what we come up with as a way to promote our business. And the other thing I think with small businesses is they can move a lot quicker. You know, if they come up with an idea at Sunday night and a barbecue and it's good enough and easy enough to execute, they can have it in place in their business on Wednesday.
Totally. You know,
exactly. They don't have to go through the clunky organization of pitching it into the agency and the agency taking it away and doing research and coming back and blah, 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 blah.
Exactly. I mean, it's crazy how small businesses don't take advantage of how nimble they are and how they are able to embrace really interesting creative ideas. I mean, there was this business called the White Moose Cafe in Dublin, in Ireland, and it's one of the it's got something like close to 200,000 people follow it. It's a small business. All this guy does is just be really candid and funny in social media. And it's genuinely great content because it's straight from the owner's mouth. Often these small business owners are characters, right?
Yeah.
Like I know my local butcher. I know my local cafe guy. They are characters in and of themselves. And letting that character flow through to their social is such a powerful thing. It's something a big business can't replicate.
I think the other thing is with things like that is that a lot of small businesses have this fear of offending people. And I think the White Moose Cafe, because we've discussed that on an earlier podcast, you know, probably 7 or 8 episodes ago, because I think he got in the news for insulting somebody or upsetting somebody, or they complained. I can't remember the actual case. But I think small businesses are worried about offending people. But I think in this day and age, you've got to realize, yeah, sure, whatever you do, you're going to offend somebody. And the chances are the more people you offend, the more people are actually going to come out and back you up.
It's funny you say that, because one of the things that one of the best agencies in Australia says, which is the Monkees, they say, you know, they're all about provocation. And I think that cannot be truer in the social media age. You know, if you're not provoking and creating conversation, then you're dull. And the reality is that in an attention economy, you have to be interesting. And people aren't interesting enough at the moment. And that's what means that, you know, no one gives a shit about, you know, some photo of a couple of people in front of a, you know, to take your example, a butcher's shop holding a couple of things in meat. No one cares.
Yeah.
You know.
What they want is something that is useful to them, that's interesting to them, they're going to open an email and go, that's a great recipe, I can make that, all I need is the ingredients from the butcher's shop, and it's done. So I mean provocation, I love that, you know, I love that idea from the Three Monkees, but provocation doesn't necessarily have to be pissing people off. It just has to be getting people's attention. You know, one way or another, and it might be with something that's extremely useful to them. It might be something that's challenging a way that they think previously. So, you know, but mate, those are all really, really, really good ideas for small businesses. What do you think small businesses do well? I mean, we've just bagged them about the things they're not doing well. What do you think they do well?
I think the good ones are letting personality shine through. I mean, I remember this other small business, Freak Shake or something like that, out of Canberra, where they were putting up these crazy milkshakes that just looked awesome. And I think it's when they let their personality shine through that's when they are doing well. I mean, it's just the inverse of what I've said, right? Which is, and you know, when they have that ability to kind of come through and show their owners, but also show their owners' personality and thoughts and really take the character of their smaller brand, which is often more interesting because it has more character. It doesn't have to be in this big bloated bureaucracy that is modern day marketing. That's where they've got their strengths, and that's when they do really well. I've seen some of the best content over the past 2 years come out of small businesses, whether it be the Freak Shake thing or the White Moose Cafe thing, or there's always a reason for small businesses to be going viral. You see it every day.
Mm.
It's and it's just often the ones with a bit of character.
And it's funny that when you see small businesses that end up becoming big businesses and big clunky businesses like the Retail Food Group in the last 4 weeks that was born out of small brands that have grown.
Mm.
It's amazing that the fact that any of those Retail Food Group brands, I would say, is devoid of any kind of form of personality that you've just said. And if they all perhaps sat and went back to basics and said, you know what, we need the personality of the owners, the people in these businesses to really shine through on a local level, it might make a big difference to, you know, where their business is sitting at the moment.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's this awkward tension, right, between growing from a small business into a big brand. And because a big brand has the budgets to make big cultural pieces of work, whereas a small business has the ability to channel a local character. It's those people sitting in the middle, which I actually think have the toughest time of all. And it's really, really hard. You've seen that with IGA's new campaign. They're trying to recapture that local spirit. They haven't quite nailed it, in my view. The Shane Jacobson ad comes off as very, very wooden. It doesn't come across as having local character or cultural influence or impact. So I think it's a difficult territory to play in.
Yeah. No, yeah, it's a really interesting, it's an interesting point because, you know, just again, on a complete side note, and it's bizarre, but where I go and buy my petrol every week, the guy behind the counter is an Indian guy, probably one of the most Australian Indian people I've ever met. And it's his personality. When you walk in the store, it's his personality. It's not the fact that it's a Shell garage or that it's a Coles associated Shell garage or that, or what's on special. It's just him and the way he says hello to you and the way he talks to you. And yeah, it makes all the difference. And down the road, there's a Caltex and there's a BP, but you just wouldn't bother because, you know, even if they were cheaper or had a better selection, but you'd go to him because just the way he is with you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, people like people, right? And intuitively, that's what brands are trying to replicate. That's why I hear brands talk about people-based marketing and all that kind of thing, because they're trying to that's why brands often try to turn big companies into humans, because actually people still crave the human touch when they interact with businesses. It's just they cannot get that from a big faceless corporation with a big bureaucracy.
Yeah. I Annie Parker, who is a former CEO of Fishburners and is going off to currently head up Microsoft's global startup plan, I interviewed probably 10 or so episodes ago. She worked in telcos in the UK, and she said when they gave the people answering the phone, when they gave them some leeway about how they could deal with the customer and how they could solve the problem, the rate at which they lost customers reduced dramatically.
Well, actually, Southwest Airlines does that really well in the US as well.
Yes. So I've used that example a couple of times with how they do the announcement at the start.
Well, they also empower their frontline staff to just solve customer issues straight away. So that customer, that personal touch and care really comes through because of the way that they set up their business. But that requires a lot of effort from big businesses. It requires a lot of thinking, a lot of planning. I think big businesses are going more that way now, but it's something that local businesses definitely have an advantage in.
Yeah. So talk to me about what you're doing at Y&R at the moment. What stuff are you working on there?
So, I mean, Y&R's gone through a really interesting period of change. I think we're probably one of the largest creative networks across Australia at the moment. We've got a fantastic heritage, obviously, with George Patz and things like that. But I think what we're trying to do now is just build that very modern advertising agency, the type of agency that can kind of handle anything from new media challenges to a big creative challenges to thinking actually creatively about businesses and brands as well, not just thinking about creativity and communications. And we're going through that change. I think we're still trying to define some of what our role is in the modern landscape, as every group is. But I think we're doing a really great job of it. And of course, I'm working with some fantastic people. My day-to-day really is figuring out what communications and amplification that our clients should be using to make their creative ideas just work harder, or what tools do the creatives have in their arsenal that they can use to kind of make the creative even better, which is a really exciting role to play.
Is there anything that you're working on right now that you can tell us about that you think is exciting, or that we'll see soon, or that kind of thing?
There's something we've just released, actually, which I'm exceptionally proud of, which is some work for Deloitte, Deloitte Australia, which is the Sound of Deloitte piece, which is all about diversity. So it's understanding kind of what happens when you add different voices or only hear from certain voices in a choir setting. And it's quite a powerful, moving piece of work just to show the impacts of diversity. And actually, if we all listen for different voices and all come together a bit more, we can do some really amazing things.
I'll get you to send that to me, because I'll share that on our Instagram so people can see that. So it's Deloitte's is an interesting brand. How long have you been working with them?
We've been doing a little bit of work with them since I got here, basically, which was probably November last year. It's a great business, great brand.
They've got their own agencies, haven't they? Or
they've got their own digital agency.
Right. Yes. Deloitte Digital.
Yeah. Deloitte Digital. Yeah. Yeah. And you know, and they do some phenomenal work. So they're just a really interesting business. So I think there's a trend in consultancies to try and broaden their offering. Do I think they're clashing with creative agencies as much as everyone is making out? Probably not. I think what those businesses are really trying to do is they're trying to engage and broaden their offering a bit more in terms of how they consult. So if you look at where Deloitte or PwC or Ernst & Young are moving, what they're really trying to say is, actually, we can tell you how creativity could play a bigger role in growing your business. I don't think they actually want to be down and dirty making the creative themselves.
No. It's interesting that you just mentioned that, because I think that's, you know, we'll go off on that tangent very quickly, but that whole PwC and Deloitte's and all the others that are starting to acquire creative agency or acquire advertising agencies, do you think the reverse is likely to happen, that big ad agencies start adding in consultancy arms where they look at a broader picture of the
already has happened
industry? Okay.
So if you look at Ogilvy Red, Ogilvy Red's probably a very fast growing and high performing business. That's a consulting arm of Ogilvy globally. So I think that kind of pushback has already happened. Will it happen more? I don't know. I suspect if I was to guess and put a finger in the dark, I'd say maybe. But I'd say that it's going to be more likely that we try to go upstream and bring creativity into the boardroom, whether that's in a consulting role. I don't know if it's quite in the same space, but it's just like they would never be quite in the same space as us. I think it's more overlap.
Okay. Last question before I do my three last questions, if that makes sense. New tech, new things that are happening in the world, AI, VR, self-driving cars. What gets you most excited for, let's say, the next, you know, 5-10 years of technology?
Well, first of all, I'm just going to say VR, I think, is complete horseshit.
Well, I'll wait till you get to the end of this, because I'm interested to talk about that. But go on, keep going.
I think augmented reality is very, very valid, but VR as a user interface does not work. It's like 3D printing. 3D printing is quite a niche product. It works in certain circumstances. I think VR is exactly the same. If I want to sit there and kind of view a future house, maybe it works there. Will we ever be walking around in headsets, kind of, you know, exploring new worlds? I really seriously doubt it. I think the more interesting technology to look at there is the neural lace.
Yeah.
which is going to very quickly displace those VR headsets. So that's not to say I don't believe in the idea of us being hooked up to a computer and somehow going into those worlds. Yeah. I just think the current vision
not with a pair of goggles on your forehead not sitting in your lounge next Oculus, to your wife.
Not with the fucking Oculus Rift. Have you seen that thing? It sits on your face and it looks ridiculous.
I've worn a couple of sets, but yeah, go on, keep going.
So look, I just think that the neural lace is going to massively displace VR. I think augmented reality, the Magic Leap. I'm not sure if you've seen that.
Absolutely.
But that's doing – I actually got to trial that the other day. That's doing a phenomenal job of augmented reality, and it's doing it really well. So I think that's definitely a big, big area. In terms of other stuff, AI is a very badly misunderstood term, if you want the truth. We're nowhere near close to general intelligence or what we call AGI. No one even knows how the brain structure works or how we kind of learn. What we have is a theory of learning called deep reinforcement learning through a neural net. And that's basically the premise of machine learning and all of these AlphaGos. The challenge with AI is how do you quantify an environment that we don't know how to quantify? So, and what I mean by that is no one quite knows how to quantify the brain and how our imagination works. And for all of the AI models that we have at the moment, they rely on a quantifiable input. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So I think that that's very badly misunderstood. Machine learning, on the other hand, very, very relevant for where we are today. And I think machine learning applied to businesses, particularly actually small businesses, there's a lot of great technology out there, which just means you could do what you would normally have to hire a consultant for on software.
And I think that will become more and more accessible in the next 2 or 3 years for small businesses, that they need to start thinking about areas of their business that they could automate or turn over to some machine learning rather than keep paying for it someone to do it for them every week.
100%. And I think that the other interesting area around all of this is that, as machine learning comes in, it's a bit like how Facebook democratized advertising. I think machine learning will democratize a lot of business processes. And I think businesses are going to become easier to scale with all of these different things. And machine learning is a space I'm actively investing in myself. So I think it's really interesting.
Just, I'm going to take a step back to your VR one because I wholly agree. When I first saw, I went to see a company based in Sydney who do AR and VR, and I was had the headset on and, I was cables running out the back of me down to the back of a PC on the other side of the room. And I'm going, the experience is amazing. And I get that this is first gen technology, but this is never getting into my lounge room. I am never sitting here next to my wife, putting a headset on and pretending I'm in the fucking plains of Africa. It's just not going to happen because it's such an antisocial, despite the fact that you're in the same thing together, it's still a very antisocial thing to do. Until I went to a VR gaming thing the other week, probably about 4 weeks ago. I'm just completely forgotten the name of it now. Zero Latency. Have you been to a VR game thing?
Oh, I have played some games in VR. Yeah, I don't mind that.
This is a free roaming VR game. So you go into essentially what is an empty warehouse and you're given a gun and a headset and a pair of headphones and you're not attached to anything. And you go in there, and I went in there with five friends, and you take part in the one we took part in was a zombie experience. So you're pretty much for the best part of 45 minutes killing as many zombies as you possibly can. And again, it's first gen technology. The graphics are at a standard of, let's say, Call of Duty, that kind of thing. It is quite confronting to start with, and then you get in and then you actually really enjoy it. And for 45 minutes we had enormous amount of fun. Now you take that experience and you overlap it on, let's say, the next Star Wars film, where you could go in and spend an hour in the Star Wars universe wandering about with your mates. That's where I think it has legs.
But I can see that.
And I would say to anybody, if you know, I completely agree with you with VR in certain spaces, but entertainment wise, and I mean, they took $66 off us each for that for 45 minutes. So you kind of expand that kind of thing and have multiple, you know, maybe one cinema within a cinema chain is, or, you know, one screen within a cinema becomes a VR space. That I can see.
Well, VR might become the new cinema then.
Yeah. Or, you know, you'd go with your mates and spend, or you go with your wife and wander through a fantastic experience.
Because there's no doubt cinema numbers are on the decline, so someone's going to have to do something with all that space.
Yeah, yeah,
so absolutely. That's really interesting. Yeah.
Okay, my last three questions. Brands that you admire, what something that you buy all the time that you really like?
Oh, good question. I'm personally a very, very big fan of Menulog, who, full disclosure, is a client, but I use them all the time.
Yeah.
I think they've got a really wide range. I think it's a fun brand, it's an interesting brand, and I prefer how they feel to kind of the commoditized feel that I feel that Uber has.
Yeah.
So just on a brand perspective, I really like them.
That was the one with Jeff Goldblum doing the advertising.
Yes. Great. Yes. I think there's, Airbnb, I think, is just such a beautifully crafted brand, particularly how they deal with their community. So they've taken kind of the idea of branding and just extended it to every single point. And I think that's an incredible lesson for people to take, is putting your branding into every single touch point possible. And I also think, you know, if you're looking globally at some really, really solid brands, I think you can't go past some of Nike's work. What Nike have been doing to build communities of athletes. And again, they've just injected that Nike feel into every touch point.
Yeah.
They've kind of built a brilliant app, which actually has genuinely good value for people. And they're also developing a great e-commerce business. So I think, you know, as a brand, they just have everything covered.
Cool. Last two questions. Penultimate question. What's next for you? Obviously you've not been at Y&R a huge time, but what other things are you working on outside of their side projects? Or you talking about investing earlier as well?
Well, so I'm an active angel investor. Okay. There's two key businesses that are a focus for me. Peasy, which works with businesses large and small to just nail their customer acquisition. We've got a really cool campaign builder and kind of do some great stuff around building those acquisition campaigns and mechanics around those campaigns. And yep. Flowbox is another business I do some work with. They're all about AI Facebook marketing, driving traffic through basically AI targeting, managing all the creative and things like that. I think those two businesses are extremely complementary as well. So that it kind of works quite well. So I think those are very, very interesting areas for me.
What are the two web addresses, just in case people want to go and check those out?
www.flowbox.io, FLOBOX.io.
Cool.
Then PZ is www.pz.com. I'm just going to check if it's .com or about you. .com.
Cool. Awesome. Last question. Where can people find you if they want to come and ask you a question, or they've got something they want to share with you? Or
I have one of the most active Twitter feeds at henryinnis.com. It's just my name.
Innis with two N's, just in case anyone was wondering.
Two N's. Yep. And it's got lots of garbage on that Twitter profile, so enjoy all the spam. But I check it every day. And then LinkedIn as well is a really easy one.
Cool. Awesome. Henry, it's been an absolute pleasure. Wish you a huge amount of luck in the future, because I know you're only young as well. How old are you now, Henry?
25.
I'm just wondering whether you're the youngest yet. We had, I've forgotten her name now, lady working for YouFoods. She was still pretty young, but I think you may have just pipped her there, mate. But congratulations on everything you've achieved so far. And obviously a very, very promising career ahead of you. So thanks very much for joining me today.
Thanks so much, Simon. Appreciate your time.
That's it from me. That is the end of the episode. Thank you very much for listening in once again. If you want to get in contact with me, as always, again, find me on LinkedIn, Twitter, simon@simondell.com. And of course, if you get a chance to go onto iTunes and rate and review us, we would all really, really appreciate that. The more reviews we get, the more ratings we get, the more people listen, and the better we can make the show for you guys. So thanks very much. We'll see you next week.